In this country, many people are still struggling to find a job or just stay afloat without regular income. Numerically speaking, the recession has hit more men than women. That is, more men have lost jobs. But it hasn't been easy for women either. According to the Labor Department, just over the last year, the number of women between the ages of 45 and 64 who are long-term unemployed, meaning out of work for more than 6 months, has more than doubled. Reporter Gloria Hillard met two baby boomer women who've been searching for work for more than a year.
Barbara Bosch is showing me around her three-bedroom condo in West Los Angeles. She apologizes for the extra clutter, a mattress and box spring lean against the wall.
So that's kind of sitting around right now.
To help her cover the rent, her son moved into the first bedroom down the hall, and she's just rented out a second bedroom. The petite 49-year-old wears her dark brown hair in a ponytail. She says it's been a while since she's had roommates.
Oh, boy. I can't even think. I think it was like in the 80s.
She says she can deal with losing her privacy if it means keeping the home she's lived in for 7 years.
That would be the last thing that I would have wanted to do is have to move too, you know, with everything else that's going on.
The everything she refers to began in July 2008 when she was laid off from her job as a bookkeeper at a small CPA firm. At the time, she wasn't too worried. After all, she'd never really been without a job. But within a month, she knew this time was different. Every day, she searched the internet from CareerBuilder to Craigslist. The rest of her week, she'd spend going to interviews set up by temp agencies.
And then they're telling me that the group of people that I'll be working with are much younger. And I'm looking at them thinking, well, I don't really look that old, you know, at all. And I think I fit in with no problem. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I haven't been getting the callbacks. I don't know.
No callbacks, so 3 months ago, Bosch made a decision. She heard the medical field was still hiring.
Okay, well, let's get started because we've got a lot to cover.
Bosch is now attending college to get certified as a licensed vocational nurse. She says it hasn't been easy being a student again, but she felt it was her only option.
I need to live, you know, in order to have a roof over my head. I've got to financially be able to take care of myself. You know, I don't have anybody else to fall on.
Across town, Denise Dubois is sitting at a computer showing me the source of some of her income, the personal belongings she's sold on eBay.
I've sold shoes. I've sold my whole set of Danish teak salad bowls.
She describes herself as a young and hip 56, someone with a film degree who has worked in marketing, development, and real estate for most of her life. She's been without a job.
It's been 13 months now. And after sending out 1,000 resumes, and I've gotten only 2 phone calls. I thought I was, quote, going to go mad if I wrote another cover letter.
At an L.A. County job center, the chairs are full. Jewish Vocational Services runs this center. Director Angie Cooper says they're seeing women of all ages and educational levels, especially one group.
They're women who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They're telling us that they can't do what they did before and that they feel there's ageism out there. They feel that their skills are outdated.
Okay, who's next to present?
Back in the classroom, nursing student Barbara Bosch takes a seat in the first row. School has now become her full-time job, and she worries that in 3 months, her unemployment benefits will run out.
I don't know what I'm going to do. I really don't.
She won't graduate and receive her nursing license until March of next year. For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. One thing's clear. The investment bank Lehman Brothers may have gone bankrupt a year and a half ago, but its problems are by no means over. A massive report released last night recounts the company's last days, and it alleges accounting manipulations and negligence on the part of the bank's executives and auditors. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, the findings will likely add some legal drama to one of the largest and most dramatic financial failures in history.
On April 1, 2008, about 5 months before the spectacular meltdown, then-Lehman Chief Financial Officer Aaron Callan went on CNBC. She touted its surprise decision to raise $4 billion from what she called longtime supporters. Callan couched the move as necessary to address perceptions that the firm was in trouble.
We, in particular, and it's an industry-wide issue, but in particular, came under, I think, the white hot lights around rumors and suppositions with respect to the strength of our firm.
In the same interview, Callan said this.
That doesn't change our basic strategy that we want to continue to move illiquid assets off the balance sheet.
In fact, according to the report prepared at the request of the bankruptcy court, Lehman was already moving its assets around, but not in a way that was transparent to its investors and creditors. According to the report, the bank's officers tried to engineer ways to make Lehman appear healthier so it could avoid a credit rating downgrade and perhaps still attract some additional capital. Lehman used an accounting practice it called Repo 105 to essentially make it appear as though it sold troubled assets, a move that would also make its debt ratio look better. As the financial crisis worsened, Lehman heavily relied on Repo 105s, ultimately using them to take $50 billion of assets off its balance sheet. According to the report, Lehman's former CEO Richard Fuld signed off on the accounting. So did the bank's auditor Ernst & Young, as did Callan and her successor Ian Lowitt. Through their attorneys, the executives denied wrongdoing, and in an email, Ernst & Young said it stands by its work. Though Lehman executives are already named in civil shareholder lawsuits, they do not currently face any criminal charges. Columbia law professor John Coffey doubts the fresh evidence in the bankruptcy examiner's report will just lie there.
Oh, I think this will probably increase the prospects of both securities litigation against Lehman executives and Ernst & Young.
Coffey says a similar report after Enron's demise bolstered the shareholder suits against it, and ultimately, aggrieved investors collected more than $7 billion in settlement money. Using this kind of postmortem bankruptcy report as evidence to negotiate a higher settlement is one thing. Using it to get a criminal indictment is another. Jacob Frankel doesn't believe the report alone suggests anyone's at risk of winding up behind bars. Frankel is a former prosecutor, an ex-enforcement official at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and now a defense attorney. He says the report's strongest language calls Lehman's executives' actions grossly negligent and materially misleading.
And that leaves out a critical word, which is false.
Frankel says the difference is crucial. The standard for criminal prosecution is that the action must be both false and misleading. Still, he believes the report leaves Lehman, its executives, and Ernst & Young vulnerable to more civil lawsuits.
What the report is clearly saying is there is a basis for anyone in the civil domain, whether the SEC or shareholders, to bring claims.
In many ways, this report has already done all the exhaustive research necessary to bring such suits. It reportedly cost more than $30 million to produce, and its table of contents alone is 38 pages. Lehman is now being unwound, and its parts are being sold off to pay off creditors. That work is expected to take 3 to 5 years to complete. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Lynn Turner is a former chief accountant for the Securities and Exchange Commission. He appeared on this program often in the days when Enron unraveled, and as a result, we all got a crash course in shady accounting techniques. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And what's so striking about what Lehman was evidently doing, at least to me, is this. They were doing it after Enron's accounting methods had drawn so much attention and after the Sarbanes-Oxley Financial Reform Act was passed. Wouldn't they have known that getting losses off the books tactically was wrong?
Yes, without a doubt, the executives at Lehman would have known it was wrong. And in fact, each quarter they had to certify to their investors in the SEC that in fact these financials were right. That was required by Sarbanes-Oxley, and yet they failed to do that. Clearly, it's not a matter of there was an requirement that they didn't know about. They just went over the line.
How common do you think this practice of, I gather, a bank taking some securities off its books temporarily in transactions designed to make the bank's books look a little bit better for quarterly reporting deadlines?
There was becoming increasing focus in the capital markets on how leveraged up these firms were, how much capital they had to sustain losses, and whether or not competitively they were in as good a shape as their competition. And while the report says Lehman had done this since 2001, clearly they ramped up this practice when there became increased focus and attention on their balance sheet, apparently, according to the Examiner, just to make things look rosier to their investors than what really existed.
But was what they were doing, was this particular technique, was it, if the intent were different, is it legal? Can a company do that sort of thing?
No, I don't think a company can do what they were doing. And moreover, what they were doing had no real business purpose behind it. Its only purpose was to create a false facade in these financial statements and a picture that had no connection with reality whatsoever.
If you were back at the SEC and your people were looking over these statements from Lehman's that they were filing in those days, would it have been impossible to detect what the true condition of the firm was, or with adequate resources and looking in the right places and asking the right questions, could the SEC have figured out this is just off? They don't have the money to back up the exposure they have.
Well, certainly given the magnitude of these transactions, which got up to as high as around $50 billion at the end of a quarter in 2008, clearly financial statements that didn't have those numbers in them would be misleading and tough to decipher. The second question, though, as to whether or not SEC examiners should have caught this, especially since they were inside Lehman, is a fair question. Auditors, just in the normal course, tend to look at transactions close to the end of a quarter. And given that a number of these were being entered into right at the end of the quarter, sales of securities right at the end of the quarter that then, quite frankly, were bought right back within a few days after the end of the quarter, and the fact that they are so large, $50 billion, it's a fair question to ask, did the SEC examiners ever look for these type of transactions in the course of their examination? And if not, why not?
Lynn Turner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lynn Turner, Senior Advisor and Managing Director of the consulting firm LEGC, formerly a Senior Accountant at the Securities and Exchange Commission, spoke to us from Broomfield, Colorado.
Women now hold half the jobs in the U.S. That means more two-career families are struggling to get the job done and pick up the kids and drop off the dry cleaning. Everyone's searching for that elusive balance, even the working family in the White House. Here's First Lady Michelle Obama.
This isn't just about family balance. This is about making workplaces stronger and attracting the most qualified people.
One way some employees are finding that balance is through flex work. We begin a series on the subject with NPR's Jennifer Ludden. She reports that for more and more people, the line between the professional and the personal is fading.
When Katie Sleep launched her own software development company, she didn't want her employees to suffer as she had.
I mean, I've worked in cities like Chicago, Houston, Texas, San Francisco, and the commute takes a lot of your day. You know, my kids were in daycare by 6 o'clock, 6:30.
In the morning?
Yeah, so that I could get to work.
Sleep remembers never eating dinner before dark, never getting to watch her kids play in the yard. Today, her company, List Innovative Solutions, is in nightmare commuter land as well. It sits amid a tangle of highways in Northern Virginia. From her office, she can watch planes take off at an international airport. So Sleep lets employees largely set their own hours and telecommute at will. And it's not just mothers who ask for this. Fathers want it too.
They want the ability to go to their children's play, which is usually at 3. It's never at 5 or 6. And what you find out is people end up getting their job done.
Okay, I'm going to put these on your desk.
Okay.
Sleep has nearly 100 employees, but on this early afternoon, many offices are empty. I catch Human Resources Director Christy Stumpf with coat on, preparing to head out in time to beat rush hour traffic and meet her children's school bus.
When I'm in the office, like, that's my FaceTime. Like, today were my meetings, filing, that kind of stuff. And then when I'm home, those are the projects that I work on, and I kind of divided out how it works best.
Stumpf's dad was also a long-suffering commuter, and she used to think that's just the way life was. Now she feels almost guilty at her own good luck.
Now that I've worked here and realize I would never, never in a million years be able to be in an office 40, 50 hours a week, commute forever. It just wouldn't work. It's terrible. It's terrible.
We're really in the middle of something like an industrial revolution, but it's really a work time revolution.
Phyllis Moen is a sociologist at the University of Minnesota. She says today's labor laws are perfectly suited to 1960. The 40-hour week, 9 to 5, all that was codified in an era when men went off to an assembly line and women stayed home. But more and more employers, like Katie Sleep, are discovering that loosening this rigid schedule works.
If you can give people something that can ease their day, your retention rate's going to go way up.
In Sleep's case, up to 95%. And study after study shows productivity also shoots up. More than half of companies now say they offer flex time, and a third allow telecommuting at least part-time. On the other hand, research also shows employees don't find their workplaces nearly so flexible as managers say. Work-family experts say arrangements are often more generous on paper than in practice and can be highly dependent on the generosity of immediate supervisors. So what about that revolution? Well, work-life experts say another force is building. Working parents are no longer the only ones who want flexible hours.
When you talk about Gen X or Gen Y or the millennials, they've taught us that we can't necessarily say work-family balance.
Lisa Horn is with the Society for Human Resource Management, and the preferred term now, work-life.
The younger generations may be waiting longer to have children or not have children at all, but yet they still value their flexibility and their free time as much as someone with a family.
You may have heard millennials in the workplace are lazy and entitled, but sociologist Phyllis Moen says that's a bad rap. She says young workers simply don't want to wait decades until retirement for their quality of life. An attitude that's been reinforced by the recession.
My uncle got laid off, et cetera. They're talking about this. They no longer believe in the myth that working in rigid ways for long hours necessarily pays off. Mm-hmm. That's a real change.
This generation is completely untethered. They had laptops, you know, in grade school.
Jody Thompson is co-founder of Culture RX, a consulting firm which promotes a completely flexible work style. She says young people today are used to getting stuff done on laptops, cell phones, iPods, wherever, whenever.
And then we bring them into the work environment and we say, here's this, you know, 6x6 square you're going to work in with a desktop computer, which, by the way, to them is a gaming computer. And here's your phone with your cord. And now you come in at 8 and you leave at 5, and between 10 and noon, that's when we're creative. And they can't, they don't even know how to relate to that type of system.
Now, before you start thinking, oh, those crazy young people, experts say yet another push for flexibility will come from an unlikely source, the very baby boomers who defined 9-to-5 culture in their prime. Sociologist Moen says they're getting older, and many will want or need to keep working well past traditional retirement.
And older workers who you may want to keep on because of their skills or contacts will want to work differently, more flexibly and less.
So where's the case against flexible work? It's not so easy to find these days. Even the staunchly pro-business Chamber of Commerce promotes flexibility, although the Chamber's Mark Friedman says it only works for some employees and some jobs.
Not all employees, not all industries, not all jobs. And I mean, you can imagine certain jobs where you have to be at the workplace, and if you're not there, somebody else is going to have to pick up the load, and that won't be fair to them.
In fact, researchers are looking into ways to bring more flexibility to low-wage, hourly jobs, and we'll look at that later this week. But even at her software development company, Katie Sleep agrees, all flex arrangements are not for everyone. She herself could never work at home.
No, it's not good for me. I like being around the people.
Sleep's also had employees take advantage of the flexibility she offers, and she's fired them. But she says it's worth finding those who can handle the freedom, even if it makes her job more difficult.
There's not a day that I don't kind of panic when I know that my workforce is all working from home. So it's not like you've got it all wrapped up and that the answers are very simple. It's whether or not you can let loose of that anxiety and let it roll. and really trust in people.
Tomorrow, we'll see how a government bureaucracy is letting loose, taking flexible work to its extreme. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Jennifer has written an essay on the struggle to have it all. You'll find it at npr.org, where you can share your experiences